Welcome, everyone. Hope everybody's having a good time here at TechEd. I want to personally welcome everybody here. Welcome to my session. This is about failover clustering, server 2012 R2. We're going to talk about all the new different features for R2, kind of demo some of it, kind of show you kind of the path that some of the stuff's been taken. My name is John Marlin. I am one of the senior support escalation engineers within the product support group. I do a lot of work with customers, both troubleshooting, training delivery, do a lot of training delivery inside of Microsoft. Work a lot with the product group, so you know, I work a lot with Eldon, Sabashis, and those types. So I like to kind of keep it a little bit on the interactive side. If you have a question, please let me know. Go ahead and step up to one of the mics around there. We will have some time for Q&A at the end. If there starts to be a little too many questions that are going on, you know, I apologize, but I may have to stop you because I want to make sure I get through everything, show everything. So with that, let's go ahead and get started. We're talking about the overview of the new feature enhancements with 2012 R2. Kind of go a little bit of the roadmap of some of the changes that have been made along the way. And, you know, I've been at Microsoft for 22 years, supporting clustering way back to the Wolfpack days when it released with NT4 Service Pack 3, if there's anybody that can go back that far. Okay, one of the first things we're going to talk about is guest clustering with shared virtual disks. This was something that was really it was brought on by the, as a request from hosters. It's what we're talking about here. A lot of your Hyper-V or private clouds running Hyper-V are running on clusters, okay? So we got the hosters, physical hardware, setting up guest clusters. Guest clusters just simply means virtual machines running inside of Hyper-V. And there was a little bit of a quandary that hosters were getting, that would get into. You know, I'm a customer, I want to, you know, have a private cloud, get this hoster to do it. We've got the new feature for Fibre Channel for virtual machines. Cool, pretty sweet, go straight to the SANs. Hosters, basically think of it as a line in the sand. There's a physical environment for the hosters and a virtual environment for the customers. Neither one wants to cross that line. So if you allowed a virtual environment, direct access through the fiber channel adapter that you can add in Hyper-V to your SAN, you've got your customer fully exposed to your storage infrastructure. Nope, hosters don't want to allow that. So what they would do is, you could still use iSCSI, so what they would do is spin up a virtual machine, put an iSCSI target on it, and let the clusters connect it for the shared drives. Well, customer says no, because you're going to charge me for that. Okay? So, a little bit of a catch-22. What we came up with was guest clustering with shared virtual hard disks. What we're doing basically is just exposing a VHD to the cluster, shared between the two, and it's a normal drive like anything else. Customer doesn't have access to the physical environment, whether it be iSCSI or fiber channel, and the customer's not having to pay that extra money for a virtual machine just for iSCSI targets. So guest clustering, you can do it with any kind of commodity storage. Shared VHD provides the shared storage for those guest clusters, does maintain the separate virtual physical environments, separates the two, so neither one gets to each other one. Whenever you create one, it actually presents it as a shared virtual SAS disk. So if you actually went into server manager, storage, disks, and so forth, you'll actually see it as a SAS, okay? It is recommended only for data disks, okay? No kind of OSs or anything else. which is basically like you would do with a cluster anyway. Okay. Here's the different methods that you can have. Again, fiber channel, iSCSI, or you can go with SMB with 2012. 2012 R2, you have the new shared VHDX. Now, shared VHDX, you can create, you have to have a Hyper-V server that's 2012 R2. The shared disks for a guest cluster, 2012 or 2012 R2. It will not work with 2008 R2 or below. Okay, so one thing you need to consider if you go with the shared VHDX. There's different methods of creating it. One, obviously, is PowerShell, and that's the command there, and I'll show you how to do it. You can go with SCVMM if you're into System Center or if it's just straight from Hyper-V settings. You'll add a new hard drive under the SCSI controller, the advanced properties in Hyper-V, and enable virtual hard disk sharing. You'd have to do that on both of the virtual machines you have, or there's the selection for it if you're an SCVMM person. The VMs generally have to be offline or down when you're creating it through Hyper-V or SCVMM. Now, one other thing that I went ahead and did with the slides, down in the corners, I've got different links for the different features, whether it be a TechNet, whether it be a blog. I think there's one or two magazine articles that were written. So we're talking about shared VHD. Here's my cluster. Okay, here's my physical node cluster. Here's my virtual machines. Okay, if I look at the settings of the virtual machines, here's my SCSI controller. Okay, and of course I can't add one because the VMs are running. So what I can do, if I run, and this is going to be from the Hyper-V host, it is add-VM hard disk drive -VM name, because we have to tell it what virtual machine we're going to add it to. TechEd 1. And then I have to give it a path to where the actual VHDX file resides. It does have to be a VHDX file. Okay, so you will have to create it with a 2012 R2 Hyper-V. Give it the path, which is... Now, the other thing is the shared VHDX file has to reside on a cluster shared volume. Okay, whether it be over the network to like a scale-out file server or on the locally attached physical cluster, but it has to be on a CSV drive. Both nodes have to be able to access it. So I give it the path to my local /, can't even type, cluster storage /, and I just called it shared VHDX. Extra D. Thank you, sir. Okay, so there's my command. Can everybody see that way up top? Okay, good. So, what did I do? Oh, no, I forgot. I have to finish the command. One of the main things that makes it shared is the switch shared virtual disk. Oops, go on. So I have to have the tag shared virtual disk to be able to do it. What is wrong? cluster storage, shared, 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 VHDX. So I put a dash in it. Oh, yeah. I'm real big with Ds. Share virtual disks. I'll get it right. So there's my command. You can do this while it's online, but only with PowerShell. Okay? So I've got it added to my one machine. I have to go and add it to my second machine. So when it does that, and I go look at my settings, now I'll see here under the SCSI controller and advanced features, and here's my box here, enable virtual hard disk sharing. Takes care of it for you, okay? So now I can go into my virtual machine, go into disk management, here's the drive I added, and it does have to be a already created and formatted drive to be able, well, it has to be a created VHDX. Okay, you can format it now if you want to, but it's not going to create it during this process. You already have to have created it. So here's my drive. I've got it in there. Now I can add it as a cluster resource. And there it is. Okay? Pretty simple in what it's doing. Okay? It's not really that difficult to do it. Okay? If I look in, if this doesn't take a long time, hopefully, cross your fingers. File and storage services, disks. Here's my drive here. And if you can see it, and actually only work. There it is. If you'll see it down here, it does show the bus type as SAS. So this is what's going to allow it to work with clustering. Okay? Pretty simple in what it's doing. Also makes everybody happy. Okay, customer's not being charged extra. Customer doesn't have access to the physical storage infrastructure. One of the other things that we've had, one thing we've always mentioned, recommended anyway, whenever you go to shut a cluster node down, whether you're going to perform maintenance on it or anything else, move everything off. Okay, before you shut it down. In 2012, we offered a new option for drain. Drain everything off before you stop. Okay? For virtual machines, all virtual machines or roles that were high or medium would be live migrated off. No downtime. Okay? Those are critical. Need to keep them up. So we live migrate them off automatically to another machine or one of the other cluster nodes. Low priority, which, you know, old file servers that hold application install points and stuff like that, we really don't care. We'll quick migrate those. So the quick downtime, save state, move it over, out of save state. It does ensure that there's no unexpected shutdowns of virtual machines. Whenever you do a shutdown of cluster, that is a cluster-controlled action. Cluster-controlled actions for virtual machines put them in a save state. That's downtime. Okay? And it's not going to go through a drain unless you do a shutdown of the system. Okay? We will move them to the best available node. What we're going to do is we're going to look across all the different machines. How much memory do you have? I've got this high priority SQL virtual machine that needs 16 gig of memory. Okay? Who's got at least 16 gig of memory and who's got the most memory? We will automatically pick that node to move it to. Okay? We'll do that with all high priority first, then low priority, and then finally high, medium, and then low. The other thing we did with 2012R2 is we also live migrate low priority machines. Now, one of the other things that we're going to we'll do is, you know, you've got these priorities of the virtual machines. We are going to, again, look to see who's got the most memory. If we have a if we don't have a machine that say has 16 gig of memory free, only got like 14 or something like that, we will start looking to shut down low priority VMs to free up memory for our highly critical ones. Exchange server, SQL server, something like that. We got to have these up. I don't care about application install point file servers. Okay? We'll also put a timer and then periodically check those for the low priority to see if memory gets freed up somewhere so we can restart those. So we're not just going to shut them down, leave them alone, and forget them. We will periodically check to see if we can bring them back up. Okay? We still do recommend that you drain it before shutdown, but if you don't, then you're fine. We have VM component health detection. So we're going to start checking now for networks. I've got a virtual machine. I've got my, you know, network that goes out to the LAN that everybody connects through. Okay? If that network goes down, 2012 and below, the VM just sits there, doesn't do anything. As far as it's concerned, everything's fine. It's running. You just can't connect to it. Okay? So what we have now is what's known as a protected network. It's an option. It's down below, and it'll be on the advanced features of the network adapters. If this network goes down, I need to react because I don't have anybody that's going to be able to connect any longer. Okay? Now, it will do it as a default. All networks in the cluster will be marked as protected. Okay? So you have to be a little careful. You know, if I've got a network that all my users connect to the machines, and then I've got a backup network that I just do backups, you know, once every couple of days or something like that, I want to make sure I uncheck that. Because if that network goes down, pull the cable, switch goes out, whatever it may be, what we're going to do is we're going to then ask all the other nodes, hey, do you have this network available? If you do, live migrate it off. Okay? So we keep production up. Now, one of the things that we seem to be getting a lot of on the on our internal aliases is everybody's pulling all the network cables. The problem with that is I've got no connectivity to the other nodes any longer. So how am I going to check to see if they're up, or how am I going to live migrate it? I've got no network. So be careful when you start testing that to make sure. It is configurable per network. Does verify that the destination node does have that network available. If it's not available across the board anywhere, then it'll just sit there. Okay? We do periodically check to see when that network gets reestablished to get you back up and going. It is a live migration, like it says there. We have optimized CSV placement policies now. You know, if I've got two nodes, three CSV, and then I've got virtual machines running on each of the CSV, I need to go ahead and add a third node in just to kind of spread it out. Generally, you want to kind of, you know, I don't want to say one CSV per node, but you want to be able to balance out the load everywhere. So what we're going to do is anytime there's a join of another node, you know, whether it be just rebooting from maintenance or you're physically adding it to the cluster as a brand new node, we will go out and spread it out for you so you don't have to. So what we'll do is we'll take a CSV drive, spread it out, so I've got one CSV drive per node. All the virtual machines that's on that CSV, we will live migrate that off as well. Okay? So we'll spread the load out for you, so it's not something you have to really worry about. It will be a live migration, so again, no downtime. Everything's about staying up. We ensure it's all distributed across the cluster. Some of the scenarios, you know, if there's a CSV that fails and it moves over, node rejoining, new node added, you know, if we cold start the cluster. So if there was a downtime for a power outage that was fixing to occur and you cold start it, once you start it up, we'll start spreading everything out. Okay, we will take care of a lot of that stuff for you. We've increased some of the CSV resiliency that we had. You know, when you're talking about CSV, you talk about all nodes, physical access to it, direct writes for each of the VMs. Okay? If we have a connection to a from, say, like node 3, loses direct connection to the node, or I'm sorry, to the drive, we're going to redirect all I/O out the network to one of the other nodes so it can write it for us. Okay? Now, we're actually relying on the server service to do that for us. This is going to be an SMB, just a normal SMB connection is what it is. The problem with it is 2012 and below, there's there's one SMB instance per server. So you've got users that may have connected in, you know, connecting to a file server, and then you've got all our traffic that might have a chance that might need to go over that network. If I've got someone that's really copying a massive file, or you know they're really throttling the network, that's going to cause us a problem with our CSV traffic. So what we did is now we've split it up. We've got multiple instances now for the server service. We've got the default instance, all the users connected in, connected to the file server, and then we've got a separate SMB CSV instance. Keeps them separate. If that user wants to copy that massive file, bog down the network or the server service there, doesn't matter. As far as we're concerned, our CSV is a separate instance. We still communicate just fine. Okay? So we have improved some of that. We've also, you know, since we're reliant on the server service, if there was a problem with the server service, we'd lose that network connectivity to the other node as well for CSV traffic. So we're going to also now, as part of the, quote, is alive check that we run, you know, every minute or so, we'll check to ensure the server service is functioning. Okay? If it's not, if there's a problem with it, we will move the CSV drive off. Okay? Try and restart the server service and so forth. So we've built some of the resiliency with the server service and CSV that we didn't have prior to this. We've also, and this is part of the health monitoring of the server service, which I mentioned. So we will check to make sure the server service is working, since it is a SMB connection that we're making between the nodes. We have CSV cache. This was actually introduced with 2012. 2012, it wasn't enabled. You had to enable it, and then you had to set up a cache. Now, when we're talking about cache for CSV and virtual machines, predominantly most of your I.O. down to the drives is unbuffered I.O. Windows Cache Manager doesn't deal with that. Okay? It only deals with buffered I.O. So what we did is we created this CSV cache specifically for the unbuffered I.O. Okay? In 2012, it was disabled as a default. In 2012 R2, it's now enabled as a default. It's just not configured for a size. Okay? Now, there is no, quote, recommended cache size that you should set up. It does take it from memory. And the reason why there's not a recommended size is every server, every, you know, bunch of virtual machines are going to be different. Some are going to use more, some are going to be using less. So it's really something that you have to kind of play around with. Now there is in Performance Monitor, there is a counter for the CSV cache. So you can actually kind of set the cache, set the size of it, monitor it, see if you need to tweak it, you know, whether you use too much or, you know, you need to lower it down, you know, either way. But so there's not really a, quote, recommended size for it. You know, we get that question kind of all the time. We do recommend that it be enabled just for the simple fact of there is so much unbuffered I.O. You know, it will give you a performance boost because we are now caching it. It's also recommended, side note, if you have SQL databases that reside on it, because it'll do a lot of unbuffered I.O. So you do want to enable it. Whenever you enable it, you do not have to restart the cluster service. Just set it and go. So there's no downtime for that. Enable block cache is the parameter for it. Block cache size. There is a blog down there that one of the product group guys wrote that really explains it, talks about it from 2012 as well as 2012 R2. So, you know, I recommend that. Go look at the blog. It's a pretty detailed blog. There's a lot of nice stuff with it. Some of the other stuff we have as far as CSV goes is the diagnosability of it. We've improved some of the logging that we'll do when adding a node. We will improve some of our logging so we can better pinpoint problems. We've increased some of our operational channel events, you know, in Event Viewer to kind of track when a resource goes online or offline or it moves. So there's better ways of doing that, which we really didn't have before. From a cluster shared volume diagnosability, we now have a PowerShell commandlet, get cluster shared volume state. Whenever we have a cluster shared volume, we have a node loses disk access. It's got to go redirected. Okay? But in 2012, 2008 R2, it just showed block redirected. Redirected mode is what it said. Wouldn't know why, wouldn't know anything else. Okay? You really had to start digging around. You know, is it a disconnectivity issue? Is it something else? Okay? It would also display it as redirected mode. Now, there are times when redirected mode is supposed to be there. You're taking a backup. You're doing some sort of maintenance on it. Okay? But because it showed redirected mode, that we were starting to get a lot of calls on it. Okay? So what we did was we removed displaying that it's in redirected mode within Failover Cluster Manager. Okay? And then gave this cluster shared volume state commandlet to show, okay, it is in redirected mode, and we will also give you a reason for it. Okay, so if we look at it, here's my machine here, and I've got one cluster shared volume. Okay, and it shows as online. If I run PowerShell, and I do a git dash, and I'll put this up so you can see it better. make sure I get it right. I'm typing. Git cluster shared 1D volume state. Okay. So here's my command. It's just simply git cluster shared volume state. That's all you need. You don't have to do any specific anything. Okay? It will list out all disks, all CSV disks, as well as break it out on a per node basis. So, for example, this is my information for node 6. Okay? It shows as block redirected, so I am in redirected mode. The reason for it is listed here. There's no disconnectivity. I lost that direct access to the disk. Okay? If I look at node 7 here, I have a direct state, so I've got my physical direct access to it, and I'm not in redirected mode. Okay? So we give you a way of telling what's going on. So now I can focus on, okay, how come I've got no disconnectivity? Versus having to try and troubleshoot it down to eventually get to no disk activity. Now you can go straight to it, fix your problem, get you back up and going. So that is pretty cool. Come on, here we go. We've made tweaks to CSV, so we are more interoperable, whatever the word is. I can't think. Previously, with CSV, you couldn't really do REFS on it. We can do tiered spaces with CSV if you want to set it up. You know, we have work with the spaces write-back caching. We can now do parity spaces. Previously, we could only do mirror and no parity for our storage spaces for drives in a cluster. We also work better with dedupe now. So now you can dedupe CSV drives. So that's a big win from a cluster shared volumes perspective. The node health detection is something that we have always had. We have to have some way of knowing, okay, who's up, who's in the cluster, are you functioning, are you answering? So we've got, basically, it's a series of heartbeats that just go between each of the nodes. Goes over port 3343, and it's basically, hey, are you there? I say, yep, I'm here, are you there? And it just goes just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, okay? Now, if for some reason we lose those heartbeats, we get a node that's not responding, we determine that it's down. So we're going to try and shut that node down, yank everything away, and get you back up into production. Okay? Default settings are down below. There's two different settings, same subnet, the nodes are on the same subnet, obviously, or cross subnet. We're in multi-site scenario. I've got nodes at this site. I've got nodes at this site. Okay? If they're spread out, we'll give more of a threshold. So it will allow for more failures. And it is consecutive. So, you know, here for my same subnet, it's five, my default five, meaning I can drop five packets, and it goes out every second. Five packets within 5 seconds, I'm down. If I drop two, then I get a couple, I drop another one, I get a couple, that's fine. Okay, you're still up. It is fully configurable, no need of rebooting or anything else, starting the cluster service, totally configurable. With Hyper-V, we did relax the settings a bit, so we allowed for more failures. So, you know, Hyper-V, it's same subnet, 10. Cross subnet, it's 20. So we did relax the settings, but we are kind of fairly aggressive with the heart beating that we're doing, because the name of the game is availability. You know, if a node is not responding to heartbeats, is it hung? Did it totally drop off the network? Okay, so we want to do it. You, like I said, it is fully configurable. You know, if you've got, especially from a cross subnet, if you have a known network latency, increase it a bit, get above what your latency is, so we don't have anything, any kind of things. There is a blog on it. Last year's Tech Ed, Eldon Christensen did a cluster networking essentials session. So you, and he talks all networks, really goes into detail about a lot of the heartbeat stuff. So, you know, recommended reading to get with that. Along with the heartbeats, we also have cluster communication that goes between everything. You know, if this node takes offline a resource or creates a resource or, you know, does whatever it's going to do, we have to have a method of sending that out, so that everybody else is aware of what's going on, okay? Now, before, it was, basically, it was good enough, okay? Think token ring for those old network guys. Token ring goes all the way around each node. That's, in essence, basically what we're doing. I make a change, I send the change out. Okay. As each node gets it, they put a little tag on there and say, yeah, I got it. I made my changes. Passes it along to the next one. Good enough says as long as at least a majority of the nodes got it, then we're good. I don't have to send it out again. Okay? So that is the... At times, and it's kind of rare, but at times, you know, if a cluster goes down, you know, there may be an update that a particular cluster node didn't get. If there was a down, like power outage or something like that, and that was the first node that came back up, then you would get into the scenario where whatever change that you may have made isn't there anymore. Okay, so I created a file server or something like that. I come back from my power failure. This one node didn't get it, so my file server is gone. I've got to go and create it again. Okay? So with 2012 R2, we added an additional option for all. Every node must say they got it. If they don't, I'll send it again. Okay? And that is the default mode for SQL Exchange, such like that, for, you know, whenever you're talking about SQL Exchange, stuff like that, you have, you know, additional resources that are going to go up and down, up and down, up and down, okay? Versus, say, like Hyper-V, which is the still the majority or good enough, because a lot of things are not going to change about the cluster, okay, from a resource standpoint. It is configurable, database read-write mode. There is a TechNet article on it that kind of explains how to do it. You can change it to all if you want it to. Don't have to, but you can. We made some improvements for our network validation. You know, we're talking about cluster communication. We're talking about heartbeats. It's all over port 3343. Prior to 2012 R2, we've got, you know, validation, test the cluster out, test everything out, test the network. The problem was it was just a simple ping. Ping doesn't go out 3343. So if you have a firewall that you've added that blocks 3343, then ping works, okay? But your cluster's not going to join. Now we're specifically testing this very specific port. Okay, these are the different options that it was. It's the validate network communications, the specific test, just as an FYI. So we can better identify if it is a firewall problem or not, because we are now testing the very specific port. Something that is new is we now have a cluster dashboard within Failover Cluster Manager. You know, one of the things that's always been, from a Hyper-V perspective, the Hyper-V teams have always said, we recommend core, a core install for your Hyper-V servers, less of a footprint, both memory, disk, and so forth. Okay? Problem with core is everything's command line or PowerShell with R2, local PowerShell with 2012 R2. So because of that recommendation from the Hyper-V teams, we came up with a dashboard, because you could still remote and do everything you want to from Failover Cluster Manager. You know, I can manage whatever cluster I want to, connect to it, and so forth. So what we did was, inside of Failover Cluster Manager, we created this dashboard, add your different clusters to the dashboard, and you get a very quick, up-to-date, fairly up-to-date, setting of all the clusters you want to that you want to monitor. Okay? This is fully configurable as far as the events, the node status. So we can see here, you know, Eldon's cluster 58 has 20 total roles on it. One of the nodes is down for some reason. I've got 4 errors in the events. These are hyperlinks, so if I was to click on, you know, the 1 down, 2 total, it's going to automatically make a connection to that cluster so I can see what's going on. Okay? If I just click on the event error status, it's in essence, it's just a simple event query. Go out to that event log and show me these 4 errors. Okay? It is configurable. I believe the default is 24 hours, and it goes off of what the... I believe, Sabashi can correct me if I'm wrong, whatever server manager is set for as far as what the events are, you can change it, or you can change it within here. The recommendation that Eldon has always had for any kind of monitoring, whether it be cluster logs or anything else, at least 3 days, okay, not just one. If I come in on Monday, you know, this the second one, the SQL CSV0, there was a failure on Saturday. Well, I come in, fire up Cluster Manager on Monday. Well, as far as I'm concerned, nothing happened. Okay? So I don't know that something happened. Change it to at least 3 days. Now I can at least see what happened, if there was a problem. Quick go to it, see what the problem was, and then I can focus my attention on it if I need to. Okay, so it's basically just a quick management tool to see what's going on. Has anything happened with my clusters? Dynamic witness. If you go for the old time cluster people, throughout the entire cluster cycle, we have always said, no single points of failure, right? Avoid them. Multiple networks, team your cars, multiple paths to the storage, and so forth. Okay? The problem was, we had our own built-in single point of failure, the Quorum drive. And this is all up to 2003. Okay? Your Quorum drive goes down, your cluster goes down. Okay? You have to react, you have to try, you know, figure out what the problem is, you can get it back up. But you have to figure out what the problem was. In 2008, we changed our total way of thinking about what quorum is. Quorum is a voting system, right? It's a majority. So with 2008, we changed it to say, okay, I'm going to assign votes to everybody. All nodes have a vote. I can have a witness disk or a witness share to have a vote. Recommendation was keep the total votes at an odd number. Okay? It's just simple math. Number of votes divided by 2 plus 1 is a majority. Okay? So if I have three nodes and a witness disk, four votes. So 4 divided by 2 is 2 plus 1 is 3. I have to maintain 3 votes to stay up. Okay? Versus just the 3 nodes with no witness, I can have 2 up instead to still keep my majority. Okay? Instead of 1. Okay? So what we did was we morphed that as we went along to 2012 and made it more dynamic, okay? Because, you know, we're talking about Hyper-V, we're talking about cluster, you know, 64 nodes, okay? I have a 64-node cluster, 8,000 VMs. Well, if half my nodes go down, I still have 32. Why am I shutting the entire cluster down? Okay, so what we did with 2012 is we made it dynamic. We will dynamically adjust as needed. Okay, so half my nodes go down. I'm down to 32. Let me dynamically adjust that to say, okay, my total votes now is 32. 32 divided by 2, 16 plus 1, 17. I've got 17 votes. I'll stay up. Okay, and you could actually get it all the way down to, in essence, one node. Now, 8,000 VMs is not going to run on one node, but hey, cluster's up. That's what we care about. So in 2012 R2, we made some more adjustments to it because everything had a vote. Well, it didn't need to have that vote. We don't have to recalculate, okay? Because as you lose votes, you have to recalculate, okay? So what we did was, now instead of calculating down, we're calculating up. So 64 nodes and a witness disk, we'll say, is 65 votes. So we say 65 votes, 65 divided by 2 plus 1, that's how many we have to keep up. Okay? Calculate as we go down. Now it's going up. Let's start with let's start with half, so it's, was it 33 votes? Let's start at that number. Let's start at the lower number. Start losing all these nodes, there's no calculation needed. Okay? So what we're actually doing is we're unassigning votes from the witness disk, is what it's doing. And you can also configure it for nodes as well. But we're starting at the lower number, so we don't have to do any kind of recalculations. Okay? So if it gets to the point where I have to have my witness resource, whether it be a disk or a share, as the picture shows here, I've got 3 nodes and a witness disk. So the first number represents it's capable of having a vote. Okay? So each of the nodes and the witness disk has a vote. The second number represents, dynamically, these are the number of votes that are currently running and needed. So we don't need that disk witness as a vote. So let's just take the vote away from it. Okay? So, and that's what we're doing. If we lose one of the nodes, then I'm down to 2. Now I'm at my halfway point. Half is not a majority. So let's go ahead and dynamically give that vote. We're going to add votes instead of calculate up instead of calculate down. Okay? That is configurable. Witness dynamic weight is the property for it. And there is a blog on it. I just didn't have it. I didn't put it up there. But now we are calculating. We also kind of got rid of the keep the votes at an odd number. Okay? The recommendation now is always have a witness. Whether it gets you to an odd number or gets you to an even number, as far as a total goes, doesn't matter. We'll dynamically adjust as needed. Okay? So always have a witness resource, okay? So just kind of looking at it, and it's just a real quick thing here. You know, I've got my cluster here. I can see here. Let me make this bigger. So I've got my nodes here. I've got my assigned vote. It's assigned a vote, so it's capable of having one. Currently, it has a vote. Okay. If it didn't need to have one, then it wouldn't have one. Or you configured it where it didn't have a vote, then it wouldn't have it. Okay. So there is a UI setting to show it. So you can easily quick jump over to see what it needs. We've changed our quorum configuration UI. Again, there's the screenshot I just showed you. We've changed some of the ways that we're doing it. We want a witness resource out there. Okay, it's going to be a tiebreaker, and I'll talk about that here in just a bit. Okay, so we want to have that resource or that witness resource. So because of that, you know, we kind of thought, okay, do we really need the same things that we were doing before as far as do we want to set it for a node majority, node and disk, node and file share? We took that all away. Does it have a witness? Does it not have a witness? We will automatically configure a witness for you, which is a disk. Okay? We'll take the smallest disk above 500 that's NTF, 500 meg that's NTFS. We will use as a witness resource. Okay? Just under validate, the validate quorum configuration shows you the same thing as above. We'll show you who's got a vote, who doesn't have a vote. So when we're talking about the quorum, you know, if I right click on my cluster, more actions, configure cluster quorum settings. If you've ever been in here, here's our options now, which is use default quorum configuration is one of the options. That's the one that's recommended. We'll figure out which resource you need. Okay, which type of witness it should be, or which disk it should be. It's always going to be a disk. Okay, you can select the quorum witness if you want a very specific drive to be there, or if you wanted to have it as a file share, or you've got your advanced quorum configuration, which if I go next, here's where I can start removing nodes through the UI as far as votes go. You know, if I've got a multi-site cluster, as an example, I've got four nodes at one site, four nodes at another site. If I get a loss, a break in network connectivity, there is a chance that my DR site nodes are what's going to stay up. So I can remove their votes so that they don't count. So if I get that loss of network connectivity, my heartbeats aren't going across any longer. Excuse me. They're the ones that are going to go. Okay? They'll shut down, restart the cluster service, and then we'll start monitoring to see for network connectivity. You can set it as no nodes, which I don't know why this is still here. But no nodes means you're like the 2003. You've got a witness resource. That's it. That's your only vote. It goes down. Whole thing goes down. So one disk can take down a 64-node Hyper-V cluster running 8,000 VMs. Single point of failure. That's bad. And then here's where I can select whichever node or whichever disk that I want. As I said, we always recommend a witness to be there. Okay? Now we're taking a step further because, you know, we're talking multi-site. Four nodes here, four nodes there, and a file share witness. There's a break in network connectivity between them. Someone's going to survive, someone's going to go down. Okay? So I got four here, four here. I need to get that witness resource, the share, as my fifth vote, so I've got a majority. Okay? Now, the problem is, it's going to go like this. These nodes are going to try and get to the share. these nodes are going to try and get to the share. So say the share is owned by my primary site cluster nodes. Well, if the DR site goes and grabs that share, it's going to stay up. My production site's going to go down. Okay? That's bad. I don't want that to happen. So in 2012 R2, now it's going to be who owns it. You're the tiebreaker. You have it. So now it's owned by my primary site. It has it. It's the tiebreaker. It stays up. My DR site goes down automatically. Okay? So it's not going to go try and yank it away because it doesn't own it. So tie goes to the winner. Winner is who owns it in baseball terms. There is an additional setting here, lower quorum priority node ID, that you can also set. So I can say no matter who owns, which site owns the file share, I can say my site 2 is a lower quorum priority node ID, meaning if there's that break in network connectivity, I'm lower in priority, I'm going to shut down. I'm not going to go try and get the file share witness or anything else. If I happen to own the cluster group and the witness, I'm just going to give it up, okay, because I'm lower in priority. Okay, I don't matter. If for some reason site 1 goes down, site 2 has the lower quorum priority, you know, it's going to shut itself down too. You can do a force quorum to start the cluster up. Basically, I don't care what your priority numbers are. I don't care anything. Start the cluster service. Force it up. Okay? And what'll happen is site 2 comes up, back up and going, back up into production. Site 1 comes back up. It's going to try and start the cluster service. Okay? It's going to, if it doesn't have that break, I'm sorry, if it doesn't have that connection, that network connectivity reestablished, it's going to sit there because it can't get any resources. Once that network connectivity is reestablished, site 2 is going to say, hey, I've been forced. I'm God. I'm it. You follow me. It goes ahead and restarts the cluster service. Okay? So that it can now join instead of forming any kind of cluster. Okay? And one of the reasons we want to do it that way is if there's an extended period of time that it's down, you know, you've had to, you know, add some resources, add some shares, you know, do whatever you need to do. We need to make sure that at my primary site gets those changes. Okay? So whenever we force it up, you're the ruling body. You've got the golden copy of the cluster hive and all the configuration for it. Okay? We've started reducing some of our cluster dependencies, especially when it comes to Active Directory. You know, starting with 2008, 2003 and below, cluster service account started the cluster service. Okay? But it was susceptible to password changes. Okay? I've got one service account that runs multiple clusters, you know, every 60 days or whatever the AD is set for, it's going to, you know, force you to change the password, which means you got to go and change the password across all your different clusters. Okay? So what we did in 2008 was instead of using a cluster service account, let's use our cluster name. You know, it's all Kerberos enabled, so we've got an AD object out there for the name of the cluster, and we'll use that for all of our authorization. Okay? Because machine accounts automatically change and update. And then, of course, passes it out to whatever machines it needs to. So now we're using the cluster name. All other virtual names, you know, whether it be a SQL name, an Exchange name, a file server name, or anything, are considered virtual computer objects. The cluster name, the CNO, has the rights to do what it needs to do in Active Directory. Okay? Or you need to set the rights. The problem became once you start getting administrators and start stripping down rights, locking down OUs. We start stripping rights that the cluster name has. It can't create any kind of objects. It can't update any passwords that it needs to. So we start having problems. Okay, names won't come online, so you got no connectivity. So we still had reliance on Active Directory with that. Now we have a new option in 2012R2 for Active Directory detached, or AD agnostic is one of the other terms you'll see, is we're no longer reliant on any kind of AD objects. We're not even going to create them anymore. Okay, we're not going to use Kerberos for anything. Okay, we're going to use NTLM. Okay, NTLM is a lower security method, so it's not for everything. You know, whenever we go with like a Hyper-V cluster, if you want to live migrate virtual machines between nodes, that requires Kerberos. That's not going to work in a situation like that. So it's not going to be something you're going to do with that. It does simplify the cluster deployments, because we're not having to create objects in AD, manage objects in AD, anything like that. Okay? That's the command, dash administrative access point, and then DNS. It'll still create a DNS object for name resolution, but no Active Directory object. Okay? So here's the different things that we have, or some of the more common uses for clusters. You know, MSMQ clusters, not supported with an AD agnostic or, you know, Active Directory detached, because MSMQ has all sorts of SPNs that it has to have on its AD objects. Well, we're not creating any objects any longer, so we broke MSMQ. So you can't use it for that. File server clusters, it's not really recommended. File servers, or network connectivity to file servers, Kerberos first. If there's no Kerberos, it'll default to NTLM. Lower security method. Okay, so that's why it's not really recommended. Hyper-V clusters, it's not recommended. You cannot live migrate. You can quick migrate, but quick migrate's downtime. Short period, but still down. Okay, the best use for it is SQL Server clusters. SQL Server has its own authentication method built into it that you can set up. Okay, so you can set up, you know, however you want to have SQL authenticate, whether it be Kerberos or not. Okay, so that's the best fit for AD agnostic clusters. Okay, you can still run the others, the couple others, but keep in mind there is no Kerberos, so that's that lower security method of connecting. Something else with cluster shared volumes is you can now, you know, when we came out with cluster shared volumes in 2008 R2, Hyper-V only. Only the VHDs can be on a CSV, that's it. Nothing else. Okay? In 2012 R2, now we've enhanced CSV so we can have it more, you know, for scale out file servers for files. You can have SQL databases, you know, SQL's running on a particular server or a particular cluster over here, while its databases reside on this cluster over here. We could take advantage of CSV that way. You know, you've got the multi-channel that can do SMB Direct. So, you know, you've got all these capabilities from a network standpoint, and I don't have to invest in storage across the board for all my clusters. I can invest all my storage in this cluster over here, as far as, you know, whether it be fiber channel, you know, all these terabytes of data they want to do. And then over here on these clusters, I can invest all for processors and memory. Okay? I can spread those out between multiple different clusters better from a cost standpoint than I can for this SAN. Okay? Because we're talking about one SAN here versus, say, three or four SANs here. Okay? Big cost reduction. Now, there is a session Thursday morning, 8:30. That's the session code, Sabashish, one of the cluster PMs over there in the corner, raise your hand. He is doing a session specifically on running SQL Server on cluster shared volumes. So if you're in, if you're a SQL admin, you know, I recommend going to that. That's it's all about what CSV is, how you store the data, setting it up, and so forth. So pretty good session. We still do the the block cache that I was talking about. It is recommended for SQL servers or SQL databases because there is that unbuffered I/O that Windows Cache Manager doesn't do it. You've got the increased resiliency. I lose connection to the drive. I can redirect my I/O out. Now, one of the things you have to kind of remember, especially from a SQL Server standpoint, is I have a, we'll just say I have a 10 gig pipe from my physical box to the physical drive, okay? So I'm just churning right along, IOPS are great, everything's fine. I lose my network connectivity, or I'm sorry, I lose my disconnectivity, okay? So I'm having to redirect over the network. Well, I didn't invest very much into my network, so my network's running 1 gig. So now I'm going from 10 gig to 1 gig over the network. There's a bit of a performance issue. So always consider that whenever you're going to go with CSV, you know, whatever network that you have can be within your SLAs. Okay, so you have to consider it. A lot of people don't think about it at first. And it's something that, oh, crap, I forgot. I needed to do that. Yeah, we should probably invest in that. Okay? But that's some of the stuff that Sabashish will talk about. We can do SQL. This is new. SQL availability groups can go in Azure on a cluster. And that's basically because there is no shared drives within Azure. So now you can create your public clouds with clusters running SQL availability groups, so which we could not do before. And that's more a SQL thing than a cluster thing. We have to have shared drives. So, but that is there. There is a link there off of the MSDN site for it. We've got all the Hyper-V replica improvements. You know, we've got a Hyper-V replica broker role that's here. So, you know, it's fully configurable, 30 seconds, 5 minutes, 15 minutes for replication frequencies, you know, offsite replication, you know, everything you can do with a standalone Hyper-V server, you can do with a cluster server. You know, we work with the Hyper-V recovery manager now. So, you know, all the Hyper-V replica improvements for 2012 R2 isn't lost on clusters. Okay, so we can do what they can do. You know, we didn't do anything. I went ahead and put in this slide here. Symantec is a partner that we've been working with as far as from an application high availability standpoint. There's a lot of work that they did on it from an application standpoint. You know, they can recover, restart apps if they needed, restart VMs, move them over to different nodes, you know, plan migrations, plan maintenance, and so forth. There's a white paper if you're interested in it. I'm sure the Symantec guys and girls, I think there's girls too, can tell you all about it, hopefully. At least there's a white paper on it to read up on it. So, but we have been working with them for application availability. So that's all I've got. So in review, you know, we've got the cluster shared guest clusters with shared VHDXs. Again, that's the hoster stuff. Completely isolate physical layer from virtual layer. AD agnostic computers. You know, we've changed some of the health detection, VM failovers, draining shutdowns, multiple SMB instances. You know, CSV is now compatible with tiered spaces, parity spaces, dedupe, and so forth. There's a TechNet article that talks about all the new features Also wrote a Windows IT Pro, if you like Windows IT Pro magazine. There's an article on that that I wrote that talks about a lot of this stuff in more detail. Some of the different related content that's out there. Again, Tsubashi's if you're a SQL guy. But that's all that I have. There's some more links here. I've got about 4 minutes for any questions anybody has. Or I'm up here for a few minutes if you need to come up. But other than that, I want to thank everybody for attending. Go Clusters.